91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Those who exhibit genius fascinate us far less skillful humans. But what factors create brilliance and intelligence? Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Could genetics produce genius? Perhaps skillful teachers pave the way, coupled with hard work. Or maybe it's where one is born, in the era when one lives. Next, we speak with former NPR correspondent, travel writer, and author Eric Weiner. His latest book is The Geography of Genius, a search for the world's most creative places from ancient Athens to Silicon Valley. Are certain settings conducive to ingenuity? We'll learn more after NPR and regional news.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents, 7 minutes after 1 o'clock on a Monday. It's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Today we consider what everyone admires, many aspire to, but few possess, genius. What fosters it? Today's guest has traveled widely and has spent much time in pursuit of the subject. He's travel writer and author Eric Weiner.
His is a familiar public radio voice. He was an NPR correspondent for many years, mostly reporting from foreign locales. But he was also based here at WLRN for a number of years. That is, until he published his first book, I remember that, Geography of Bliss.
Eric Weiner's newest book is The Geography of Genius, a search for the world's most creative places from ancient Athens to Silicon Valley.
And he joins us via Skype from Dubai. Hey, we'll find out more about why he's there as well. Hello again, and welcome, Eric Weiner. Good to hear from you.
Hi.
Hi, Eric.
Thank you, Joe and Bonnie.
Hi,
can you hear me?
We can.
It's a little bit crackly, but we can get by.
Yeah,
all
no,
right.
It's okay.
It's great to be talking to both of you.
Thank you. Well, Eric, it was a revelation to me. I didn't know until I read your book. I never realized how much Paris and South Florida had in common, because according to your book, neither is a center of creative genius. So that was a revelation for me. Why isn't Paris in there?
You know, I considered writing about 1920s Paris and Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald and the rest. To be honest, it seemed a little bit obvious, and Woody Allen's movie Midnight in Paris had just come out. And I thought, well, do I want to go follow in the footsteps of Woody Allen? And I found places like Vienna and Edinburgh that were equally as genius like as Paris, but I thought more interesting and more surprising in a way.
Well, we know that from your last book, as Joe mentioned, The Geography of Bliss, geography and place fascinate you. So what led you to look at the factors that spawn genius?
Well, first of all, let me be clear that I'm not a genius, despite what you may have heard otherwise. And
remember, we work with you.
Okay, so you know that. All right. But you're right that I do view the world through the prism of place. And it seemed to me that the realm of creativity and genius, you know, these realms have largely, we don't think of them in terms of place. We have this myth of the lone genius who creates his or her great works of art or science, whatever it is, entirely alone, divorced from the world. And that's just not true. In fact, you know, I think that place matters a lot more than we think when it comes to creative genius.
So you spend a lot of time looking for them. What seems to create a genius cluster on a very basic level?
Well, on a very basic level, it has to be a city for the most part. There are exceptions. Silicon Valley is probably the best known exception. But, you know, there's an old African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it seems to take a city to raise a genius. There's something about the density and, in a way, the intimacy of an urban environment that's conducive to creativity. You know, if nothing else, cities are where the people are, and you actually, you know, I do believe that genius is ultimately a social verdict, that, you know, we decide who's and who isn't, and you need people to do that. So I would say the first thing you need is, with a few exceptions, to be in a city.
It's interesting because you just mentioned, you know, it almost as though we're just as important because we have to recognize the genius. There may be many geniuses that aren't recognized, but we'll get to that in a minute. But would you define how you're defining genius?
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what I don't mean. I don't mean just intelligence, just a high IQ score. To me, that, you know, that means you have high IQ. It doesn't mean you've created anything for all time. So I'm talking about creative genius, but what, you know, what counts for creative? Well, I like the definition the U.S. Patent Office has for a creative product that you want to have a patent for. It must be new, surprising, and useful. I think if you look at the geniuses through the ages, they tend to hit all three notes. Useful, I would use interchangeably with appreciated, but there needs to be that leap, that surprising part, I think, is the key. My favorite quote about genius is from the philosopher Schopenhauer. He said, talent hits the target no one else can hit. Genius hits the target no one can see. So there's always that big leap.
Oh, okay. You're cutting out a little bit. Are we going to call back? Is that what we want to do?
Maybe we could do that. Is that okay with you, Eric? We could take a short break and get back with you?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, we'll do that.
We're speaking with Eric Weiner, and he's written The Geography of Genius. We're going to take this short break, establish a better connection, and we'll be right back. We're back with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we continue our conversation with a better connection with Eric Weiner, former foreign correspondent for NPR, philosophical traveler and author, and a recovering malcontent. He's written The Geography of Genius, a search for the world's most creative places from ancient Athens to Silicon Valley. Eric, what are the seven genius clusters, and what was your criteria for choosing them?
Well, as you pointed out, they're not the only seven genius clusters. There are others. I had to make some tough choices, or else I'd have a 2,000-page book. But I came up with some that are fairly well-known, such as Athens during the Classical period and Florence during the Renaissance, but also some that are lesser-known, such as Edinburgh, Scotland in the 18th century, and Vienna during the time of Mozart, and then later the time of Freud. And some places that I think are really off the map, at least for most Western readers, and that would be Hangzhou, China in the 13th century, and Calcutta, India, in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. They were all places where you saw this explosion of creativity.
You mentioned Vienna twice in the book, or two periods, mm-hmm. and you talked about that Vienna was saved by the Ringstrasse, or the Ring Street, and you called it the birthplace of the modern world. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, that was Vienna of 1900. I call it Freud's Vienna, but there were a lot of other geniuses at the time, Gustav Klimt, the artist, et cetera. And what was interesting is it was a city, really, of immigrants. I mean, the population in that city just exploded like fourfold in just a few decades. And this is something you see in a lot of these genius clusters, is they tend to be places where immigrants are welcome, where there's a lot of vitality, where you have a crossroads of ideas. You know, I think it's safe to say that Pyongyang, North Korea, is probably not going to be the next great place of genius because it's not open. It's not an open society. And Freud's Vienna was very much that way. You would hear dozens of languages spoken on the street, And so much of what we consider modern, be it architecture or psychology, came out of Vienna of that time period.
You also say that when we think of ancient Athens or Renaissance Florence, we conclude they were hotbeds of creativity, knowing what we know now. But you said they weren't likely spots, which surprised me. Why weren't they likely centers of genius at those times?
Because they were kind of crummy places, to be very blunt about it. You know, Athens, the birthplace of so much that we hold dear, was really kind of a dump, even by the standards of the day. The streets were crowded and dirty, and the walls and the houses were so thin that robbers could simply dig through them to get access. And the land was barren. It was not a fertile land. And Florence was malarial and was decimated by the Black Death, the bubonic plague, just a few decades before the Renaissance. So I think my point here is that it seems that creativity is always a response to a challenge, that these places are not paradise, because, in fact, paradise, if it existed, would probably be the least creative place in the world, because you have nothing to push against, nothing to strive for. Mm. And so all these places I look at, including Silicon Valley, created challenges for the people at the time, and some of those people responded in very, very creative ways.
But speaking of Silicon Valley, was that where the genius was created, or was it just more imported to there? It happened to wind up there.
You know, Joe, yeah, it's always a mix of the two. These places do become magnets for talent and creative people from far and wide, but they have to become magnetized in the first place. So, you know, Silicon Valley is like the other places in that way, in that there was a nascent, actually, radio industry going back to the 19-teens. In fact, interestingly, you can trace the beginning of Silicon Valley, the early seeds of it, to the sinking of the Titanic, because after the Titanic was sunk in 1912, Congress passed a law requiring all ships to carry radios on board. It was a new technology at the time, and the heart of it was in Palo Alto, California, where there were a couple of radio firms, and it actually helped. But yeah, there were the seeds and the magnet, and then you have this exponential effect where you have people flocking there.
When you say that the genius of Silicon Valley has very little to do with technology, what do you mean by that?
I mean that, yes, the product may be technology, that's what comes out of there, but the means to produce it, you know, the creative ecology is really about human relations and has nothing per se to do with technology. It's not that they have access to technology, really, that we don't have elsewhere in the world. So what makes Silicon Valley special is this system, and it really is a system, even if it's an informal one, that's very good at picking ideas that are worth pursuing and backing, because in fact, very little was actually invented in Silicon Valley, not the cell phone, not venture capital, not many things that we associate with the place. What they were, though, is perfected there. That's what Silicon Valley really excels at. Mm.
Going back to Athens, I thought it was pretty interesting that you say they were open to new ideas with the arrival and the arrival of new immigrants, given their penchant to protect themselves from outsiders in the interest of security, which is, of course, what we're experiencing now, not only here, but around the world. So why did Athens allow them in?
Maybe they were a little bit crazy and bold, I would say. And Pericles, the leader at the time, says as much. He says, you know, we let these foreigners in even though they may have nefarious purposes in mind. And I think they recognize on some level that there was a cost-benefit analysis, that the large number of immigrants that they allowed in and allowed to live in Athens, actually, presented a risk, yes, to their security, but that there was a benefit. Plato once said was what the Greeks borrow from foreigners, they perfect. And part of that borrowing was actually allowing people to move there.
So borrowing has its own form of genius?
Yeah.
Knowing what to use and what not?
I really do believe that so much of what we consider just radically new is usually, if you look carefully enough, is borrowed from elsewhere. You know, Isaac Newton famously said he could see so far because he's standing on the shoulders of giants. But we live in a society that doesn't usually acknowledge those shoulders or those giants. There's certainly, that's the sort of mythology in Silicon Valley, is that, you know, along comes a new app or a new gadget and it just came out of nowhere. And in fact, if you look carefully, as I did, you'll find that it's almost always borrowed from elsewhere, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
When is it called borrowing and when is it called stealing? Because, you know, I was thinking back when I was reading your book to early composers and music, when it was a common practice for composers to borrow ideas from one another, from themselves. And beyond that, they would even take themes from each other and compose around them or write variations on them. But today that would be called plagiarizing or stealing, wouldn't it?
I suppose it would, or maybe, you know, I borrow and you steal. It depends on,
who's
on your
doing
perspective,
it.
Really, doesn't it? Yeah, it depends on your perspective. You know, Goethe once said that we're all plagiarists and we might as well admit it. and I know it sounds anathema in our day of plagiarism and our sensitivity to the subject, but it's just, his, I think, a way of shaking us up and making us realize that everything is based on something else. You know, T.S. Eliot said that the poet needs, if he's creating a poem, needs those dead poets who came before him, that you're part of a trail, whether you acknowledge that trail or not.
In these clusters, there were also elements of competitiveness and threat, you know, that somebody was going to take your idea, maybe do better with it, or you were competing for money. I mean, money was an important factor at these times. So how did they deal with that?
Yeah, they were competitive, and that's one of the areas in the book where sort of the real world of what we know about these places butted up against what psychologists have found in the lab. In the lab, competition tends to squelch creativity, at least among beginners, beginning artists, for instance. But if you look at Athens or Florence, you're right. You saw that they were very competitive, and that this tended to bring out the best in people, or at least, well, not the best personally, but at least the best work. I mean, Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo really did not get along at all. And Michelangelo was a couple decades younger and was seen as the upstart, and this bothered Leonardo da Vinci, who eventually moved to Milan. I think the difference is if you are experienced, if you have some mastery of your subject, then yes, competition can help you up your game. But if you're trying out playing the violin or shooting basketball hoops, then the competition is going to squelch you.
You say there are three D's that foster creativity. Talk about each of them, especially I want to know about the disorder and the chaos, but name the three D's.
The three D's are diversity, discernment, and disorder. And I guess we've talked a bit about diversity, but I don't just mean ethnic diversity. I mean diversity of ideas. And having this one trait that psychologists have identified as the single most important trait for creative people, and that is openness to experience. And that means open to diverse views, and I think places have that as well as people. And discernment, which often gets short shrift, is essentially separating the good ideas from the bad ideas, not acting like, you know, every idea is equally good. They're not. You know, Jonas Salk, two-time Nobel Prize winner, was once asked by a student, you know, how does one come up with so many good ideas? And Salk said, well, it's easy. You come up with lots of ideas and you throw away the bad ones. That's discernment. And disorder is just this sense of tumult and even a bit of chaos in a lot of these places. They're not Switzerland. You know what Graham Greene infamously said about Switzerland, 500 years of peace and stability, and what have they brought the world but the cuckoo clock? But he is on to something, that places that are totally Pacific and calm are not places of genius. Places of genius tend to have a little bit of foment going on.
How about those who led the Industrial Revolution in America, the Gilded Age, so-called? Was there genius in the Rockefeller, Carnegie, or is that just organizational? Even Henry
I'm
Ford?
I'm about to back to you guys. I'm not sure. What do you think?
Henry Ford?
I think Henry Ford is sort of a borderline case. I think if you go by the idea that genius is a social verdict, I don't know if the vast majority of us would say he was a genius because he was so specialized, and I don't know whether he transcended that specialty. I'll tell you what I mean. Like, Mozart is not really referred to as a musical genius, nor is Einstein referred to as a scientific genius. They're just geniuses, pure and simple. They've transcended their field. Henry Ford is seen as a smart, shrewd, certainly courageous automobile guy, but I don't know if he was more than that.
You know, it's an interesting point because it seems like geniuses from the past were ingenious in a lot of spheres. I mean, take Leonardo da Vinci, even Benjamin Franklin, really, or Edison, their genius did transcend one area. So spread out. Whereas today, it seems like you hear, as you're saying, oh, he's a technological genius, or he's an artistic genius, or a musical genius. So what has changed there that they have? Maybe the times demand that you have to focus in on one thing now?
I think you're onto something. I think the culprit is, in a word, specialization. Back in Leonardo da Vinci's time, there was not the degree of specialization we have today. And, I was at a dinner party the other day talking about this with a friend, and he said, well, of course, there's more specialization today. The world's more complicated. But I would argue the world's more complicated because there's more specialization, at least in part. And what the specialist does is learn more and more about less and less, and to carve out a sort of area of knowledge and build kind of a fortress around this little domain of knowledge and not really allow others in. And that is really not conducive to creative genius because, creative genius is not about knowing. It's about seeing. Einstein wasn't a know-it-all. He was a see-it-all. And that means seeing connections across disciplines. And you need to be to do that kind of intellectual trespassing if you become a genius. And that's why I really do think, and there's some empirical evidence of this, that at least in the scientific realm, we have fewer geniuses today than we have in centuries past.
That's really interesting. If you'd like to join in the conversation, your views on genius, would you have included some other? We're going to get to also Calcutta and Edinburgh and China, because those are really interesting and surprising places. But maybe you have some views on genius. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or
email, that's radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. We're speaking with Eric Weiner. He's the author of Geography of Genius, A Search for the World's Most Creative Places from Ancient Athens to Silicon Valley.
And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return with Eric Weiner, author, former NPR correspondent. We're talking about his book, The Geography of Genius. Eric, how about particularly in the American and perhaps British realm, say literary in the early to mid 20th century, and the alcohol, the commonality of alcoholism? Hello, Eric. Looks like we maybe have lost connection with him again.
Okay.
I still have him punched up. And
we're gonna get him again.
Yeah, we'll call him again. So I'm on VIP this. Why don't we talk to Paul while we do that?
Okay.
Paul in Miami. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing? This is Paul Anderson here.
Well, maybe we'll be able to answer your question, but go ahead. Maybe you have something to talk about.
We're not geniuses. We may not.
Okay, comments. You know, it's common that people call Leonardo da Vinci a genius, but would you jump off a building with his parachute? Or he was hired as the Minister of Defense in Milan, but his city was sacked and his employer was murdered. And so, is that genius or is that meddling?
Well, look at Bobby Fischer and his life.
Right, but Bobby Fischer was good at chess, and that's what his main game. Yeah. Leonardo da Vinci said, I am a Minister of Defense. That's what he just claimed to fame was. That's what his job. But imagine if you were in the Defense Department in Washington. Washington is sacked and the president's killed. You wouldn't be considered a genius.
Well, but he certainly invented so many things and his paintings.
None of his things worked. None of his things worked.
Well, let's see what Eric Reiner has to say. Let's bring him in.
I can't do that without. All right. Let's see. Okay, conference him.
Yes, here's a classic example: Leonardo's bridge. His bridge, and an eighth grader could look at the bridge and say, "This is why it doesn't work." So why couldn't Leonardo look at his own bridge and go, "I get why it doesn't work"?
Eric, okay, while we had lost you, Paul from Miami called in and he has some gripe about Leonardo da Vinci being considered a genius. Eric, go ahead. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, his classic bridge, which is a famous design. Any eighth grader can look at his bridge, Leonardo da Vinci's bridge, and say, it doesn't work because. So then why couldn't Leonardo look at it and go, oh, I get why it doesn't work.
I guess, you know, there's the cliche about hindsight being 20/20, but the thing about Leonardo da Vinci, too, is that he got a lot of things wrong, and he didn't finish a lot of what he started. He left a lot of incomplete tasks and projects behind and failed at some, and as you say, maybe failed to notice something that we now see as obvious. But that's true of all geniuses. Geniuses fail more than the rest of us do. They just hit more out of the park as well.
Yeah, but I failed to see where it hit it out of the park. Nowadays, you could never be considered a genius like Michelangelo or like Leonardo da Vinci because of the Internet. If I say, I want to build a space station, they go, oh, it's already there. I want to travel in space, and I draw a picture of it. Oh, we already did that. But in Da Vinci's time, information didn't travel around like that.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we don't know what we haven't done. I do agree with you, though, that there does appear to, it feels like there's less room for these true leaps. But there have been times throughout history where people have felt that this is it, we've got it all figured out. In fact, you know, a couple decades before Einstein came along, physicists were convinced they had physics all figured out, and one famous physicist said, you know, all that's left now is working out the decimal points. So we go through these stages where we think we have it all figured out. There's nothing yet really heroic to do.
Yeah, the old saying, well, we've gone about as far as we can go.
Well, thanks for calling, Paul.
No problem. All right, enjoy your program.
Eric, I want to go back to a question or something I mentioned, but I want to ask what you found about this. Because you have to recognize genius for the genius to be considered a genius, maybe there would have been more genius clusters had certain people been thought of as geniuses as opposed to crazy, because I don't know what I have in mind specifically, but I'm thinking that often people are considered crazy when they're actually geniuses.
Well, I mean, not to get too philosophical, but I would say they're crazy until we all agree that they're a genius.
Right.
I really don't believe in I don't believe that they're an undiscovered genius.
Okay.
That there's such a thing. That it really takes. It takes two. It takes the creator and the person who recognizes the creation. And without the two, you just have a crazy person, essentially.
Before we lost connection with you, Eric, I brought up the point about, particularly in maybe American and British literature of the 20th century, early 20th century, the correlation between alcoholism and genius in the literary world. Did you consider that?
Not just the literary world, but many artistic endeavors.
Yeah, painting.
And there have been studies done, Joe, that actually show that a little bit of alcohol just below the legal limit, they would pump up some college students or whoever with alcohol to test them in the lab and found out that they did produce more creative ideas on the creativity test after having a bit of alcohol. There does seem to be something to that. Now, whether they can consolidate those ideas and enact them is another question. And certainly, I think, while a little bit of alcohol may make us a bit more creative, a lot of alcohol makes us fall down, and that's not good.
I'd like to go to China, though, this Hangzhou, China. What happened there?
It was amazing, Bonnie. I mean, it was, you know, we're talking 12th, 13th century, the Song Dynasty. Well, you know, European cities are little hamlets of maybe 50,000 people, beset with disease and really pretty backward by any sense, in any sense of the word. Hangzhou, China, is a city of a million plus. They're inventing the compass and woodblock printing and producing art and poetry. And, you know, this is, I think we all have a vague idea that this was going on, but until I started researching this book, I did not realize the extent and the breadth of the Chinese Golden Age.
So, okay, the compass, and what else, other than what the things you just
and printing, woodblock printing. But again, it didn't catch on the way Gutenberg's invention did, and this is fascinating. That it, you know, it takes the timing is so essential that they didn't quite see the utility of that idea, but they did, you know, invent many things, including toilet paper, seriously, which is not a small thing, and paper currency, and a lot more.
Wow.
And there is a slightly different approach to creativity in China. It's not exactly the same as the Western approach.
And how does it differ?
You know, we're so focused in the West on novelty that, you know, remember those three things I mentioned, something has to be new, surprising, and useful to get a patent, to be considered creative. Well, in the West, we're really focused on the new and surprising part, I think, the shock effect. I think in China, they're more focused on the usefulness, and they see creativity as based on tradition. It sounds a little oxymoronic, but right. There's something to it. They see it as part of a long thread, and you're not, you know, they really don't fully buy into the idea of creative destruction in China.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, we're speaking with Eric Weiner about his book, The Geography of Genius, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Next up, we have Frank in Miami. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just have a comment, and I'll take my question off the air. Could it be that we don't have more geniuses or people of that sort because everything is like within a box, like people are not thinking outside of it and going and using other theories out there, like for instance the electric universe and stuff like that to mesh with current thinking in order to come up with new thoughts and new ideas and so on and so forth.
Okay, Eric?
I mean, I think we are perhaps a bit more risk-averse, certainly than, say, during the Renaissance time in Florence, where, you know, people did take big risks. And, you know, unlike Silicon Valley today, you know, the risks are not as great as they appear to be in Silicon Valley, because if you fail at your venture, your new app, or whatever it is, chances are you'll get backed by somebody to do another one. That was not the case in Florence. They were working without a net. So I think the caller is on to something that perhaps we are more risk-averse today, perhaps we feel that we have more to lose, and therefore we're less willing to risk it to, as he says, think outside the box.
Yeah. So, well, if I could add also, the way that research is, like grants and stuff like that, the way it's programmed, I don't think, only the theories that are, I guess, trendy or whatever, are the ones that get the big bucks to do the research, to do the outside thinking. And everybody else is really just not funded.
There's something to that. We tend to, not just in research, as you say, but think of a company that's hiring someone, right, to do job X. Well, what are they going to look for? They tend to look for someone who has done job X elsewhere, exactly the same job or pretty close to it. You know, that was not the case, again, just to go back to the Renaissance, and this time with Michelangelo. You know, when the Pope Julius II was going to have the Sistine Chapel, the ceiling painted, you know, and he essentially put out bids for the job, so to speak, Michelangelo was not the obvious choice. Michelangelo was mainly a sculptor, had done not much in the way of painting, certainly not on that scale. But the Pope, who was a member of the Medici family, the big patrons of the Renaissance, he said, I'm going to place a bet on you. You've shown talent in area Y, and I'm going to choose you for area X. And that's the sort of risk-taking that I'm talking about that I'm not so sure we engage in today.
Well, also, Eric, we don't have benefactors. We don't have people like the Medicis that are going to, you know, be benefactors for artists, for example. It's hard to find those today.
Right. I mean, in Silicon Valley, you know, you can argue the Medicis are the venture capitalists,
right,
who back certain projects, but of course they require hope for a very high rate of return. But yeah, the art world, I think, has become narrower than it was in centuries past. It used to be something I think people more broadly got interested in. Now it's really, and I think sadly, more of a sliver of our society, and one that, as you say, is not always back the way perhaps it should be.
We're speaking with Eric Weiner, and a former foreign correspondent for NPR. He's written The Geography of Genius, A Search for the World's Most Creative Places. Our last break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, visiting with Eric Weiner. He's written The Geography of Genius, A Search for the World's Most Creative Places, from Ancient Athens to Silicon Valley. We have an emailer.
We're just discussing this.
Yes, Antonio has written, what could have happened in Liverpool for the Beatles to have occurred starting the British invasion?
And post-World War II.
Joe and I were talking.
Had gone through the Blitz and all that.
Right.
Yeah, they did live through a difficult time. And again, that's pretty common for geniuses, both personally and on the bigger societal level. You know, a large number of geniuses lost a parent when they were young, usually a father, a really disproportionately large number. I don't know if that's the case with the Beatles, but certainly...
yes, it was.
In the shadow of World War II. Yeah. And they were in a port city of Liverpool, and they started off, of course, on the edge of what was, you know, the center of the creative life in the UK, of course, London. Eventually, they did move to London, and that's often the case. You know, you think of Mozart moving from Salzburg to Vienna. You start in one place to sort of, you know, get your head start, and then you move to the big time.
You know, I was, when you mentioned losing the parent, it's interesting because you say optimists tend to be more creative than pessimists, which sort of puts the kibosh on the notion of struggling or angst-filled genius. But then you say that many geniuses suffer trauma at a young age. So it's an interesting combination. It means they must overcome the loss of the parent or the trauma.
Right. Absolutely. They, you know, you can be an optimist who suffered some trauma. And I should point out that, you know, children who suffer this sort of upheaval, like the death of a parent at a young age, tend to go down two tracks. Either they become depressive and delinquent, frankly, or they move on to, they become creative geniuses in the smaller cases. But yeah, it is a reaction, and I have to be honest here. It's a mystery why, you know, some people, when faced with this trauma, go on to greatness, and others give into despair. I don't think any psychologist have the answer to that. But
exactly.
You're right. It's one or the other.
Right.
And next up, we'll move along to Tony. Tony's in Aventura. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Interesting conversation, and I'm sorry that I missed some of it, so what I say may be a little out of place, but I'm driving and I'm sitting at a light and thinking of Garrett Morgan, who invented the traffic light, who was also someone who created a number of different inventions that made a difference in our society here in this country, but is a little known person. Not many people know him, and we actually have something called Black History Month to help Americans in the world understand that people like this even exist. But based on something I heard earlier, and correct me if I'm wrong, the premise that someone is crazy, but if someone else likes their idea and sees the use in it, then it can be considered genius, and that person can be considered a genius. And it seemed to be some value put on doing more than one thing as opposed to having one brilliant genius idea that ends up materializing or actualizing into something that makes a difference. So it all seems a little not quite connecting in my mind, because I also just heard you mention like the difference between people who have trauma in their early life, like a child losing a parent, and then they can go down different paths. They can either be, you know, well-adjusted and go on to great things, or they could suffer from depression, as if the latter is a problem that interferes with genius, when, in fact, quite often, many geniuses have suffered from depression, or this thing we now call ADD. So I know it's a lot of toss out at you. I'll kind of set up and listen now.
Okay. Eric, any response? I mean, he said a lot of stuff, and I mean...
Yeah, I have to be honest here. I don't quite... is the question... why isn't the inventor of the traffic light considered a genius?
I guess he was just lamenting that he's been overlooked.
Well, and he was also saying...
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was also thinking, and he also said there are many depressive people that have been geniuses. And, you know, I was thinking as he said that, of course, Van Gogh, Schubert, Schumann, you know, there are the list, Beethoven even was definitely depressive and had good reason. But that was his point as well.
Well, Mozart, too.
Well, as far as addressing the first point, I would say if enough of us got together and decided that this man, and I confess I don't know of him, who invented the traffic light.
I think he said Garrett Morgan.
Garrett Morgan, okay. Well, then Garrett Morgan, you know, if enough of us care about Garrett Morgan, he will rise to the level of a Steve Jobs or a Thomas Edison. And it's kind of up to us to say, hey, this guy's a genius. That we, as the audience, that we are actually participants in this whole process, that we are... in a weird way, kind of co-geniuses. Without us to appreciate Mozart or Beethoven's music, there is no Mozart or Beethoven. Likewise with Garrett Evans, inventor of the traffic light. As far as the connection between depression and creativity, there definitely is one, more so in creative writers and artists than in creative scientists, but even there you see a bit of a correlation. But I think that when someone... I'm speaking a little bit from personal experience here, to be honest. When someone is really in the throes of a deep, dark depression, they're not producing work. That you need to actually be in that more optimistic mode to create. And I'll just share one brief story with you. This was actually from my first book, The Geography of Bliss. I was in Iceland meeting with Hilmar, who was a classical composer, very good, very accomplished, and also seemed to be happy, and this was confusing me, that he was happy and creative. And I asked Hilmar about it, and he said, well, it's easy. I am overall a happy person, but I cherish my melancholia. I cherish my melancholia. And I think that he was onto something, that all creative people have that side to them that is a bit dark, And in a way, they don't reject it. They cherish it, and that actually helps fuel their creativity.
Mm. Okay, well, that kind of, you know, I just thought of so many more musicians, including Brahms. But anyway, and Unrequited Love. But we only have about a minute and a half left, so I'm really anxious to know how your malcontentness is going and what it means to be a recovering malcontent.
And why are you in Dubai?
Yeah.
And are they connected?
Yeah, and are they, yes.
I'm actually in Dubai for the World Summit, World Government Summit, talking to some world leaders and others about happiness. And there's still a lot of interest in about what government can do to make people happy, people like me, I suppose. As far as my malcontentness, I wouldn't say I'm happy, but I would say I'm less unhappy. Does that count for something?
Yeah, sure. Is that because you're no longer a correspondent and you don't have to deal with the news every day? Maybe.
You know, there might be something to that. I tend to wrestle with big ideas like creative genius and happy subjects for the most part. And despite this depressive thread we've been talking about for a few minutes, I think ultimately the characters in my book are heroic and worth celebrating, and happier than the daily newscast usually.
Yeah.
Did anyone from the MacArthur Foundation contact with you to be on their board to select the genius grants?
Select them or be selected?
To help select them.
I mean, you can nominate me. Please, go ahead.
Okay. Eric Weiner is a philosophical traveler and author, travel writer, journalist, former foreign correspondent for NPR. Also, he is recovering from his malcontentness. He's written The Geography of Genius. His earlier book was The Geography of Bliss. I guess that's why you're in Dubai. But this is The Geography of Genius, a search for the world's most creative places from ancient Athens to Silicon Valley. And thank you very much, Eric, for joining us.
Thank you, Bonnie and Joe. This was great.
Okay, take care. And that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our program was produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Associate producer is Polly Landis. Tune in tomorrow at 1 o'clock for a program with longtime journalist Jim Auchmuty. He tells a story about a community near Atlanta in the civil rights integration era. It's called The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road of Forgiveness. You can also order flowers and help WLRN for Valentine's Day. We'll be having details.
Details to follow.
We have free audio archives available at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page.
Actually, you can find out also at WLRN.org about the flowers. Valentine's Day's around the corner.
Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on NPR News.